You're listening to episode 89 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? I wanted to thank BookCon for sponsoring today's episode. BookCon is the ultimate celebration of books where your favorite stories come to life, and it's all happening this weekend on June 3rd and 4th at the Javits Center in New York City. Hang around at the end of the show to find out more about BookCon. A huge thank you to our amazing listeners who recommended and shared our podcast with friends and left incredibly touching iTunes reviews. Our most recent iTunes review was left by username Alexandria Lin, who gave us 5 stars and wrote, "Enthusiastic and engaging, Yin does an incredible job interviewing people in the writing community, professional and amateur. Her easy manner and genuine excitement never fail to draw me into her episodes and get me pumped about writing and reading. Thank you so much for everything you do, Yin." Alexandria Lin, thank you so much for taking the time to leave that touching review and for being a part of our community. I am so grateful to you. On to the next part of our show, be sure to join our private Facebook group. It's the perfect place for you to be if you're looking for a loving community to hang out with fellow storytellers and to check in with each other about your work in progress. Our group is filled with support and encouragement. We also post threads where you can submit your listener questions for upcoming interviews with really cool guests. We just recently started recording live Facebook videos that's exclusive only for our members in the private group. We're talking about book hauls and unboxing videos, and sometimes I'll even record live videos where I'll chat with members in our group while I prepare dinner. So be sure to come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. You'll feel right at home, and I'm so excited to meet you in there. That's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. One more thing before I introduce today's guest. We have 3 listener birthday shoutouts. A very happy belated birthday to Karis Rogerson, Ray Huffaker Chang, and Tina Crossgrove. I hope you ladies had the most amazing time celebrating your special day. Wishing you all the joy, love, and fulfillment. Now on to our show, we have New York Times best-selling author Emily Barr with us today. Emily started her career as a journalist at The Guardian before backpacking for a column assignment, which inspired the lightbulb moment for her first book concept for her novel Backpack, which then became a New York Times bestseller. She's gone on to write 11 more books for adults, and we have her on the show today to discuss her experiences writing her young adult debut, The One Memory of Flora Banks, which was listed as Entertainment Weekly's most anticipated young adult novel of the year. In Emily's episode, we talk about why it's okay to be selfish and clear time for your writing. She shares her experiences working as a journalist for The Guardian, writing a column in the sports section before she transitioned into writing novels. We go into detail about her young adult debut novel, The One Memory of Flora Banks, and how Norway inspired the setting of her story. We also discuss the research process behind anterograde amnesia and how Emily weaved that into her character's story. Further into her episode, we also discuss important non-writing related topics like what it's like being middle-aged and having to take care of both your children and your parents, and what it means to truly live in the moment. Now let's dive right in. Hey everyone, we have Emily Barr with us today. She's the author of The One Memory of Flora Banks. She's so sweet. We just got to chat a little bit beforehand. Emily, it's so nice to have you on the show. I'm so excited to have you here. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well.
I'm truly so excited to have you on. And I gotta say, the way your team sent us your book, it was beautiful and brilliant. I've never seen anything like that. And it's just such a thoughtful way of letting us know about your book. I think it's a reflection of you and your team. Before we get into your new book, The One Memory of Flora Banks, I'd love to introduce you to the community and have you share a little bit about how you first fell in love with writing, how that came into your life when you were younger.
As soon as I could write, I always had a little notebook and a pencil next to me. My father was a professor of film studies. He has written a lot of books about his subject, Laurel and Hardy, Hitchcock, those kind of things. And I have a really vivid memory of lying in bed at night, aged about 6 maybe, and listening to him writing, which was the clatter of that old style typewriter. and knowing that dad's writing his book. And it made me feel like writing a book is something you can do. I never grew up thinking it wasn't something you could do. I was always writing little things, always reading as I grew up. Through the teenage years, I think I wrote terrible, terrible poetry, which luckily I must have destroyed at some point because I don't have it anymore. I went through journalism and then ended up writing novels. It's been a constant since I started being able to hold a pen.
I love the influence that you had growing up. I know there's quite a few people I've talked to where it never really hit them that you can be an author because they didn't grow up with influence around them, making them realize this is something you can do. Many of them grow up with parents who are in 9-to-5 jobs that are very either business oriented or they're just like, oh, why are you in the arts? Why are you in the creative field? So I think that's a blessing that you had that growing up. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah, I was very lucky to grow up just knowing that you could work.
Is that something that you try to instill in your children as well?
Yeah, I have 3 children and for sure none of them is interested in becoming a writer. I would love it. I used to sometimes actually pay them to sit down and write a story
what?
With pocket money. Yeah, and they still won't do it. But yes, I know they know that if they wanted to write a book, they could write a book. Who knows, maybe one day. I'd be surprised though.
Oh my gosh, and how is your partner in all of this bigger picture?
He's a writer as well. He writes books for children, little children picture books. He is also a lecturer at our local university in children's literature. So when we're both at home writing, we'll just sit in the same room across the room from each other. And every now and then I'll be like, I don't know how to get out of this plot hole. What can I put? And he'll put everything down and we'll work it out. It's fantastic. I try and do the same for him. It's quite different when it's picture books, but he is so familiar with everything I write that in the middle of nowhere, I can say, I don't know whether I should do this chapter in the third person. And he'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It's great to have that support.
That's so sweet. I love hearing about relationships like that. I think that's so beautiful. That adds more depth to the relationship for sure. Just understanding and knowing each other so well where he just knows exactly what to do to get you out of that funk. I think that's so rare. And lucky you. How did you two meet?
We live in Cornwall, which is right down at the far western tip of England. It's where the beginning of The One Memory of Flora Banks is set. If you're a writer and someone else is a writer down there, you just end up meeting them.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. What was a book that really influenced you growing up?
So many of them. I remember the book that made me think this is the book I want to write, and that was Cat's Eye by Margaret Atwood. I remember reading it as a teenager and just thinking this is the kind of book I wish I could write. That was incredibly inspiring. As a younger child, so many books I would read. One of my favourites is A Little Princess by Frances Hodgson Burnett, which is a real classic rags to riches story of a little girl coming to London in Victorian times, and her mother's died and her father brings her and puts her in this very posh little school, and she's enormously rich and she has everything she possibly needs. And then her father far away dies, having lost his fortune, and she's got no money, and the nasty woman who runs the school can't throw her out onto the streets, so she stays there, but she has to live in an attic and be a maid, and they all treat her horribly. And then it has the perfect ending where everything comes good for her again. And I loved that book. I remember going to sleep imagining I was her sleeping in her little attic bedroom and the snow outside in Victorian London. I absolutely lived it. And one of my favorite things about it was recently that I read it to my own daughter, who's 10, and I read it to her a couple of years ago, and she loved it just as much as I do. So that's one of those rare things where it just goes on down the generations. It's lovely.
I love classics like that. It becomes part of your family heirlooms where you just pass it down, especially books passed down from generation to generation, to hold and touch the same book too, and turning the same page that your grandparents or your parents did when they were your age.
Yes, it really is. It got all kinds of extra layers to it, hasn't it? Where the pages contain the story. And then I know my young self has read that story. And the reading of it is the thing that really completes a book.
Yes.
It has to be read as well. And then the story's gone on to another person. And then to have the same book going to the next generation is really magical.
Also, even just thinking about the different interpretations that each person has from it. I bet if you all came together to discuss the book, it's just interesting to see what you took from it. It's almost like a self-reflection of what they're going through or what their hopes and fears are. It's a beautiful thing. Thank you for sharing that with us. If you can give us a snapshot of The One Memory of Flora Banks and give us like a overall view of what it is for listeners who may not have checked out the summary just yet.
Yes, it's a story of Flora. Flora's 17 and she lives down here in Cornwall at the far end of England, where we've got the sea on three sides. We're right out at the edge. She's got anterograde amnesia, which is no short-term memories, because she had a brain tumour when she was 10. In the removal of it, she'd lost her ability to make new short-term memories. So she can remember things up to the age of 10. And then for the last 7 years, she loses her memories after a couple of hours. She's got a very strong spirit to her. She writes things on her arms and her hands. She's got notebooks. She's got post-it notes all over the place. So she kind of externalizes her memory to writing things and reminding her future self. And she's also very, very protected by her parents, particularly her mother, who keep her in this little town in Cornwall, which is a remote place at the very, very edge of Europe. Everybody in the town knows her, and she's really protected until she's got this best friend, Paige, who's been her best friend since they were four and who's really looked after her over the years when she's needed it. Paige's boyfriend, who's called Drake, is leaving Cornwall. He's only been here for a few months and they had a quick relationship, and now he's off to go to Svalbard, which is up to the way beyond the north of Norway, up near the North Pole in the Arctic. It's his goodbye party. And the night of the party, Flora gets a bit freaked out by it and leaves and goes and sits on the beach. And then Drake comes and sits with her and she ends up kissing him, which is very bad behaviour, particularly on his part. Then the next morning, she can remember it. So it's the one memory that has broken through her amnesia and she can remember it. And the day after that, she can still remember it. So off Drake's gone to Norway, and Flora's got this memory, which she's finding amazing, and she's holding on to it and thinking maybe this is the beginning of everything coming back. You know, maybe it's a cure or something weird's going on. This coincides with her brother, who lives in Paris, who's quite a bit older, and he's extremely ill, and her parents have to go away to his bedside. So she suddenly finds herself with a little bit of leeway that she doesn't normally have, and realises there is a possibility she could go to Norway and find Drake and see what it was that broke through her memory. I don't want to give it all away, but most of the book is set in the Arctic. So she's off there in the Arctic by herself with her post-it notes, her notebooks, her writing on her skin, and trying to track down this boy and seeing if he's got the cure for her, which obviously life isn't that simple as kissing a boy and everything's better. It's not like that. It plays with that idea, but twists away from it.
I think that was an amazing overview of it. Anterograde amnesia is so specific. What inspired you to write the story, and also why anterograde amnesia?
It was quite a lot of things all at once, actually. I've read lots about it before and even more while I was writing the book. I actually started writing it because I'd written previously 12 novels for adults. The 12th one of them was called The Sleeper, and it was set on this night train we have between London and Cornwall down here. And it was a psychological thriller and it had sold quite well. And I was supposed to be writing, all my then publishers had said to me was, write something like that again. All I wanted to do, I don't know where it came from, was write a book set in the Arctic in the summer. So it's daylight all the time and the sun doesn't go down at all. I think it might have come from a dream, actually. It was just the idea of writing a book set in a snowy place where it's light all the time. It was just totally consumed me. I'd never had anything like that before. So I was trying to write this book, this psychological thriller that I was supposed to be writing. My heart just wasn't in it. So in the end, I cleared a week and I took myself away to the Arctic, to Svalbard, which from here is not so far away. It's a few hours on a plane to northern Norway, and spent a week there on my own, just walking around in this unbelievably beautiful place where there's snow on the ground, there's snowy mountains all around on the horizon. You can't leave the town because there's polar bears. So you're not allowed to leave the town unless you're with somebody who's got a gun and knows how to use it. They don't really shoot the polar bears. They scare them away by firing a gunshot. I was keen to establish that.
That's crazy that they're right outside of the town.
I went back there earlier this year to see what it was like in the winter, and they'd had some polar bears strolling into town and walking down the street.
Oh, how cute.
Cute and scary.
I probably shouldn't encourage and say cute because I don't want people to go up to them and start petting them. But my gosh, they look cute, but would be scary to be near.
Just get far away quickly and find someone to fire a gun to scare it off. I went out on a boat trip one day, which was just like magical, getting on this boat in the Arctic and the boat goes away from the town and there's just everything. There's a whole of nature. The sky was blue and it was freezing cold and there was snow, and we did see some polar bears, but we were on a boat and they were on the land. It was nice and safe and they were absolutely beautiful. beautiful. A mother and two babies.
What a sight. That's amazing.
To go back to your question, I had been wanting to write a book about memory because it is so interesting. I remember my grandfather when I was a child. I remember being taken to visit him when he had Parkinson's and was in quite advanced stages of it with dementia. Just seeing this man who I'd always found really quite scary, it did make a big impression on me. Then I did a lot of reading about memory. There were things that I'd read previously. There's one particular one about a man who lost his short-term memory and had a short-term memory of a couple of minutes and was constantly being excited to see his wife every time he looked at her because he'd forgotten that she was there. And I saw a documentary about him. He was a musician. It's always been at the back of my head. And then there was a part of me thinking, well, you can't write a novel about someone with amnesia because it's such a cliche. Everybody's done that. When I went to the Arctic, I thought, actually, you can, because it's interesting and it is something that happens to real people. It's not a cliche. It's a thing that people experience. So I just started writing this book, and then I did a massive amount of research about anterograde amnesia and discovered that was the name of the kind of amnesia I was thinking of, and wrote it from there really, and then rewrote it many, many times to get it right.
Wow, I'm so sorry about your grandpa, by the way.
That's all right. That was years ago.
Was that your grandpa on your mom or dad's side?
On my dad's side.
Were you close to your grandpa?
I always found him a little bit scary, actually.
What? Why?
He's from Northern Ireland and very British.
More dry?
Just a little bit scary compared to the grandparents on the other side. I think that was one of the things that makes such an impression on me when he was suddenly not himself at all. I was only about 9 or 10 and it was really, really disorientating and strange. It did stick with me, obviously, forever. And there's a lot of that in this book.
As a child, when my grandma, she had Alzheimer's, it was really hard because she was like my mom. For me, it was really tough getting through that. But not only because of my grandma having it, but also observing the people around me who had a huge impact on their lives and seeing how they were. And it just shifted family dynamics. For your grandpa, do you remember observing your family members around you?
Yeah.
How did his illness affect your family members?
My dad took me and my brother to visit him, seeing my father being the grown-up to his father in a way, the way it all shifts and the younger generation are then very much taking care of the older generation to quite an extreme extent. Those shifts in dynamics are really strange. I feel very middle-aged now because I've got children and I've got parents that are, thank goodness, healthy and fine. I feel very aware of being in the middle of, to always be aware of the people older and the people younger, and I guess that's middle age for you.
I don't have children, but definitely am at that age where a lot of my friends have children. The more I see photos of their kid, it instills a fear in me. Obviously, I'm happy for them, but I can't help but start reflecting about my own life and thinking, can I be there to help my parents if things were to come to that point? Are they going to be okay health-wise? You get to that point where you're like, oh my gosh, like I can be a caretaker if I did decide to have children. Also, I would have to make sure that I'm at a point where I can also take care of my parents. I don't want to just throw them in some old folks home. That's not the way I was raised. That's not part of my culture. Definitely when you're at a certain age and you realize like, holy shit, it's not just me. It's me, children, and parents. I'm sure that's something that you and your husband, and is that something that you guys have talked about?
My mother and stepfather live very close to us down here in Cornwall, which is wonderful. They're amazing. They do quite a lot of childcare for me. I know that things will change over the years. I suppose you just have to live in the present and know that you'll work things out when what's the right thing to do, and then just do it. It's just too hard trying to think, well, what would we do if this happened? What would we do if that happened? I get really freaked out trying to think of scenarios that might happen.
I know, right? And then you end up skipping the present moments because you think too much and you're living too much in the future of what if. All the what ifs. And I think that's also something that I get trapped when I start thinking about the future. I get very locked in those thoughts and I end up forgetting, oh my gosh, you know, I have this moment right now and I'm not even living it. And you have your kids that you can be spending those moments with instead of locking yourself up in your head and worrying about the future. Thinking about too much about the future, I'm letting this moment slip by and these kids are going to grow up super quickly. In the end, I'm just going to regret about both future and past and present. Thank you for diving into that. Emily, I do remember reading your bio and you mentioned that you got commissioned to go traveling for a year and you came home with the beginnings of the novel that you set in the world of backpackers in Asia. I would love to know a little bit more about that side. I know you started working as a journalist in London. Was this specifically tied to your journalism work?
What I really wanted to do was write a book. I was working for a newspaper, The Guardian, in London, and I had a day job bit, but I was also writing a column in the sports section, which was really strange. It was at the time of Bridget Jones and those kind of things, which started out as a newspaper column.
Bridget Jones started off as a newspaper column?
Yeah, in The Independent.
Why am I so late to this game?
Yeah, it was just a little column in The Independent, which was, it's also a London newspaper. It was just a little funny column written in the character of Bridget Jones, and it was really funny. I loved it. And that was in my era of journalism, when it was just a column, and then it moved to a different newspaper, and then she wrapped up all the columns into a book. Then it became incredibly popular and best-selling, and then there was the movies. It spiraled out of that.
That's so awesome. Thank you for covering that.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
Tying it back to the commissioned work, what was that about?
I was writing this sports column, which was fiction. It was like a Bridget Jones-style thing, except I had to pretend that I lived with a man who was obsessed with football in that very British way. And I didn't, but this Bridget Jonesy kind of thing. And I was thinking, yeah, I'm really enjoying writing the fiction much more than the rest of the day job of the actual journalism. I was surrounded by people who were amazing journalists and really focused and ambitious and everything. And I was feeling that wasn't me, really, and that I'd much rather be doing the bit where you get to make things up. It was fun. I worked with amazing people. I loved my job, but I just knew that it wasn't my actual job forever. One day I was at work and the guy who sat next to me came in and he very dramatically hung himself in his chair and went, "I've just resigned. I'm going to go to Scotland and write a novel." I just had this moment of thinking, "Oh, you lucky thing." And then thinking, well, he made that happen, so that isn't really luck. Just on the spur of the moment, I sent an email to the travel editor of the newspaper saying, "Why don't I go traveling for a year backpacking and I'll write a column for your travel supplement while I go?" And I just thought she must get asked that every day. And I was just waiting for her to say, "No, of course not." But she sent me an email back going, "Yeah, okay, when can you go?" I was commissioned to write a column, the ongoing story of my travels, once every 2 weeks for the news. I was able to negotiate a massive discount off around the world air ticket because of crediting the people who sold it to me in the column. And so I was away for a year by myself. It was really scary. In the time between asking if I could go away and actually leaving, I regretted it many times. So I set out from London and I started off by going to Rio, which was amazing just because I had a friend who'd recently moved there to be the Guardian's newspaper correspondent in Rio. So I went to visit him first for about 3 weeks, which was just great. And then flew up to Miami. I went across the States by train to California, which was...
Are we talking about Amtrak train?
Yeah, it was an Amtrak train.
That's the nicest version of trains that we have. It's not as fancy as the ones that you have. That's amazing. Do you have the whole hookups with the beds and everything in your train?
Yeah, it was really... I was just stare out of the window. It was absolutely amazing. And it was a train from Miami to LA.
Did you have to switch off somewhere in between?
The only changing point was Orlando, where you went from being the line going north onto being the line going west. It was amazing.
Do you remember what season?
It was summer. It was so gorgeous. And just to step off when it was stopping in a station for a while, just to get off and go, "I'm in Texas." It was so exciting.
At which other stops were you really loving?
Oh, it was all just amazing. The looking out of the window, the whole New Mexico. I just loved it. I just read books and then looked out of the window just for about 5 days.
That sounds like a dream.
I went to California, which was amazing. Spent a few weeks there. And then I flew to New Zealand, where I had some family to visit, and Australia, where I have more families. That was great. And then I went to Asia for the second 6 months of the year. That's a place to go and travel by yourself.
I need to know what places in Asia you were at.
I started in Vietnam.
Oh, I didn't even get to go there yet. I want to go so badly. Did you go all the way up?
Halong Bay, yeah.
I see photos and it's gorgeous. How was it?
Vietnam was amazing. By then, it was the day before New Year's Eve. I landed late at night and I went to a place to stay. And I woke up in the morning thinking, right, this is New Year's Eve. I don't know anybody in the whole of Asia. I was totally on my own.
No.
And I was like, right, I have got to meet somebody today to do something tonight. Because it's like December the 31st. So I went out and I was shamelessly looking for backpackers. Going, "Hi, can I be your friend?"
What did you end up doing?
I met a really sweet Australian couple who were really nice to me. And they invited me to go out with them that evening. And we went to a nightclub in Saigon called Apocalypse Now, and it was all themed on the Vietnam War. It was really strange. And it had ceiling fans that were, there were murals painted all around it. So they were like the helicopter blade. It was such a strange place. I was out in Vietnam, so it was really exciting.
Where else aside from Vietnam did you go?
All by land. I went from Vietnam to Laos and through Laos and then into Thailand. And that was just great. And then back again into Laos. And then I flew up to China, to Kunming, got a 24-hour train. I do love the long train journeys.
The 24-hour train, is it throughout China or were you trying to get out of China?
I was trying to get to Tibet. So it was from Kunming to Chengdu, which I don't know if it's still the case. It was the only place you could fly into Tibet from. I went to Chengdu and that was great. Met up with some more people there. Flew to Tibet and traveled through Tibet, which was amazing.
I would love to go to Laos one of these days. And I would also love to go pop by Myanmar. I hear it's beautiful. And of course, seeing the photos, it's gorgeous. I'd love to stop by Vietnam. I've never been to those three spots that we just mentioned and talked about. That sounds so cool. Do you plan on going back to Asia anytime soon?
I would so love to. I then went into India and Nepal, and that was amazing.
How long were you in Nepal for?
3 or 4 weeks. It was magical. Now that I spend all my time looking after my children, I look back on that. I'm so glad I did it. It's such a luxury now to be able to do that.
Doing it on your own, it's such a brave and courageous thing to do, especially being a female, not being sexist whatsoever. You got to be cautious. I was traveling with my girlfriend, so at least I was with somebody. I have traveled on my own as well, but more so in the European countries. In Asia, we bumped into some guys. It was very sketchy. They were like following us with cameras and just watching us. We always hear about sex trafficking, and it's very real and it does happen. And I am not one of those people who are playing ignorant or just trying to brush it to the side. I get so on high alert. We're just like, okay, we just have to be really careful because in these countries, I don't know the law fully. I don't know the men really respect the women, if what I say is going to be held true on their end. You just got to be careful. And I think that's so amazing that you went around Asia and did it on your own. I think that's really badass of you. How long was it again?
It was 6 months in Asia altogether. And I wasn't on my own very much. I mean, I was on my own, but I found other women traveling on their own. You would just travel with people for a while and then go in different directions. I found it was very easy to meet up with other travelers.
You're such a social butterfly. I would be a little shy.
I think when you're there and you're so, my New Year's Eve, when you're so desperate to be taught somebody, it breaks down the barriers. I was always really shy, but I would talk to people then, because it was just so great to have people to hang out with.
Oh my gosh, Emily, you're so cool. You got your own eat, pray, love situation happening. Next time, if you make it out, you should go check out Taiwan and Malaysia. In your bio, you mentioned that your second YA novel is set in Rio. So your travels really affect your settings in your books.
Yeah, I went back to Rio with Craig, my partner, last year, because having set The One Memory of Flora Banks in the Arctic, I was thinking my second YA, I want somewhere that's as far the opposite of Svalbard as I could possibly find. That was the most different place I could think of from a pristine, empty, snowy Arctic place. You could kind of say it's work. So I was like, yeah, I think we need to go on a work trip to Rio. So we did that.
Better write it off as a research project.
Yeah, exactly. Great to have the places in your head and then go back and see what's the same and what's different. And then when you're there as a writer, you're also picturing your characters there and just seeing it slightly differently. It's my favorite thing.
I love that. Do you mind if I throw in a listener question? She is a fan of yours.
Oh,
Yasmin Fisher. She said, this is your YA debut. Is it scary to dip into a new audience all over again, despite having a lot of books out already? Also, what's your process like in terms of moving your writing voice from adult to young adult? She'd love to try writing for grown-ups one day, but she's not sure if her voice will come off too YA-ish.
Great question.
Yeah, right?
It was quite scary, actually. I didn't even set out to write this book as a YA book. At first, I was trying to write it as an adult book. Everything I was writing, it wasn't quite working. And then it was actually Craig, my partner, who said, why don't you do this as YA? I tried it out, and that was the thing it needed. So it all fell into place. I didn't go, I know, now I'm going to write some YA that turned out to be YA. Yes, it was scary. You know, YA readers are amazing and brilliant, and they're so incredibly active online and generous. It feels like the community of YA readers are totally unique and different thing, and it's brilliant, but it is also scary. It's like going, hi, I've decided to come to your world now. I hope they're nice. I hope they don't mind.
Oh my gosh, this is the best world to step in for me with the podcasting. I never meant to have the podcast focus on YA. My acting career led me to podcasting. I was starting off interviewing more so of my friends who are TV writers, screenwriters, producers, directors, then segued into adult fiction authors to have them on the show. And then I was like, okay, might as well throw in the mix of young adult as well, because the core of this podcast is about storytelling. So there is no discrimination across any kind of genres or styles, sharing whatever it is you want to share to the world. And I notice the YA community, holy moly, they're just so kind and so generous and so nice and very encouraging and very supportive of each other. So I'm sure you've noticed that already. You're going to notice that even more as time goes by. They're fantastic. If you want to break into any kind of group and not feel ostracized, this is that one group I would say, yeah, you'll definitely feel welcome.
Looking amazing so far.
And now the second part of Yasmin's question is, what's your process like in terms of moving your writing voice from adult to young adult?
Yasmin, that is an amazing question. It took me quite a lot of time to work out what needed to change and how it was different. It's quite hard to quantify what it is. But I was working with an amazing agent who's Lauren Pearson in London at Curtis Brown. She was the one who really helped me. I would send her chunks of the book and she would say, what, you need to be a little bit less cynical, more sincere, more open to the emotions of things. And as soon as I tried it lots of different ways, and then once I felt it worked, then I would still get manuscripts back from Lauren with Be More YA written on certain passages of the book. Once I worked out what Be More YA meant, it was awesome. I really like writing in that. It does feel less cynical. You're poised on the verge of being an adult. Who am I going to be? It's something I remember so clearly, and I still feel it now, really, that what am I going to do? Who am I going to be? What's my life going to be like? It's all the big questions, really, isn't it? You've just got everything to play for with YA. It's really intense, and I really love it.
When you mentioned you had the notes of making it more YA, and then you finally figured out what that meant, could you share what you figured out? Because for me, too, I am curious, what does it mean to be more YA? There are some YA books out there. I'm like, damn, I thought this was for adults.
Obviously, I could only talk for the book I was writing. From The One Memory of Flora Banks, I feel like in my adult books, there was always just a little bit of cynicism and a little bit of, you don't have to go deeply into the emotions, you can just laugh things off. I felt with this one, Be More YA was meaning, don't be afraid to get right into the feelings and emotions of it and the big questions of life and growing up, life and death and everything. For me, it felt, don't feel you have to kind of laugh it off. Just really go there and go deep into it and see what happens.
I love that. Also, we did have another listener question who's also very excited to submit, but we already covered it because we were talking about your experience in Svalbard, where the setting was for The One Memory of Flora Banks, also about your visit. But I do want to let you know that we did have another listener who admired your work and wanted to hear from you. So it was perfect.
Oh, thank you, lovely listeners.
You're amazing. And Emily, if you can look back and remember if there was one hardest scene that you had for writing your newest book.
I always find the most difficult bit to write how the book ends. I have over the years noticed that we want an ending to be really contracted and drawn out. The One Memory of Flora Banks, I spent ages writing it, and I wrote it again and again and again, and I knew the feeling that I was aiming for, which was unpredictable but hopeful ending of leading on to implying lots of amazing things could be about to happen without tying every little loose end up. It took me weeks and weeks and months to feel like I was happy with the ending.
Thank you, Emily. How do you feel you've evolved creatively throughout your entire writing career?
I think if you do something enough, you get better at it. So when I wrote my first novel, which was called Backpack and set in the backpacking world, I had no idea if I could actually do it. And I remember I got signed to a publisher before I'd finished the book. I had about 6 months to write another 80,000 words of this book, and I didn't know if I could do it or not. And I did it on pure panic. Over the years, I've done 12 of those books. And I think now I've learned to plan a story rather than just start writing and see what happens, because that is a lot less scary. And also to get an overview of how the whole book will be, which when I was first starting out, I just couldn't have done that because I was just so scared about the page in front of me and just write that page and write the next page and hope it's okay. I think having all these years of experience of it, I can get a better sense of what the finished book is going to be like and picture the finished book and then just try and write that, because it saves a lot of time. I guess it just becomes less scary once you know you can do it and you know you can reach the end of it. And then you also know that there's an immense amount of rewriting and editing involved in every book. And that's okay. In a way, that's the fun part, when you've got a book and it exists and then you're just going through and making it better. I really enjoy that part.
With the One Memory Flora Banks, what is your number one hope that you would love for listeners to take away after they put down your newest book and reading that final page?
What I love is when people tweet me and say they cried at the end of it. That's my favourite thing, making people cry, although that sounds a bit mean. I think that Flora, throughout the book, she thinks of something and she thinks that could be a rule for life, and she writes it down. And the very last page of the book is just a list of Flora's rules for life from throughout the book in the order that she wrote them. Also, she has Be Brave as a tattoo on her hand, which she finds out during the course of the book exactly how it got there, because she wasn't sure. Her story is all about being brave, and I would like, by the time somebody reads her rules for life at the end of it, and being brave is part of that, that I would like people to come away thinking, just go for it and be brave, try and assemble your own rules for life, go out there and do something, even if it feels impossible.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, Emily, I know that you are a busy mom. You are balancing your career and you're kicking ass at it. And also, you sound like you're in such a happy relationship with your partner as well, Craig, who sounds like a godsend. He sounds amazing. So tell him I say hi. Knowing that our community, a lot of them are parents who are trying to make their author dreams come true. A lot of them have manuscripts. A lot of them are working on their manuscripts, have literary agents, or are trying to get literary agents. Overall, seeing it in a bird's eye view, knowing what you've gone through, making time for your writing, making time for your career, making time to be that amazing mom and such a great inspiration to your kids, showing them that, hey, I can be an awesome mom, but still have my thing going on. What can you share with those specific listeners? What can you share with them? That's hard. I don't have children and I'm struggling.
Yeah, we need more hours in the day, don't we? It's really hard. I think if you just can clear, even if, like you say, 15 minutes after the kids have gone to bed, and just write something every day, just 200 words. If you could do 500 words, if you do 1,000 words, it just stacks up. I know your listeners have manuscripts and all kinds of things, but just don't worry about being selfish and clearing a little bit of time for you. My favourite time to write, if I can manage it, is to get up before the kids do in the morning. I'll sometimes set an alarm for 5 o'clock, get up, make a coffee, and then it's just so quiet. There's no point being up that early if you're not going to get on with it. So then you can have the most amazing, clear-headed bit of writing time if early mornings work for you. Or late at night. I've got a friend who's a novelist. She's a mum as well. And she writes between midnight and 2 o'clock every single day. And she gets a book out. And just find the thing that works for you. And don't worry about feeling selfish. You've got to do your own thing. You can do it. It can be done. Just do a bit every day and it'll happen.
Thank you so much, Emily.
That was so much fun. I really enjoyed it.
And that wraps up our episode with the lovely Emily Barr. Emily, it was so nice chatting with you about your experiences and writing process. Storytellers, I hope you enjoyed Emily's episode. Please say hi to her on Twitter at Emily_Barr. Head over to her show notes page for the resources she recommended over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/EmilyBarr. Are any of you going to BookCon this weekend? If you are, let me know on Twitter or in our private Facebook group, because I'll be there too. BookCon is the event where storytelling and pop culture collide. You get to experience the origin of the story in all its forms by interacting with the authors, publishers, celebrities, and creators of content that influence everything we read, hear, and see. We're talking about panels and Q&As with the authors, celebrities, and content creators. You'll get to stop by for autographing sessions, and there's also a show floor with the most influential publishers in the world. You'll see special guests including Kevin Hart, Bill Nye, yes, the science guy, Kristen Ritter, and Jason Reynolds, to name a few. You'll also see many of the amazing guests from 88 Cups of Tea, like Matt De La Pena, Sarah J. Maas, RJ Palacio, Marie Lu, Cami Garcia, Leigh Bardugo, and many more. Check out thebookcon.com for more information. info. BookCon is the ultimate celebration of books where your favorite stories come to life, and it's all happening on June 3rd and June 4th at the Javits Center this weekend in New York City. Head over to their website, thebookcon.com, to learn more. And don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other storytellers. You can also submit questions for future guests on our show, and we recently added live unboxing and book haul videos. So join me over in our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. There's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours. I cannot wait to meet you in there. Join us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.